It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. The man who killed James and Denise Kloss and kidnapped their 13-year-old daughter, Jamie, learned Friday he will spend the rest of his life behind bars. Barron County Judge James Babbler sentenced Jake Patterson to life in prison without the possibility of release. What questions do you have about the sentencing of Jake Patterson? The number is 800-642-1234. Rich Kramer is WPR's reporter based in Eau Claire, and he was in that packed and emotional courtroom. Rich, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
So Jake Patterson had pleaded guilty, so there was no trial. What was it like in the courtroom as the judge hands down that two life sentences without the possibility of parole and 40 years for kidnapping?
Well, I wasn't in the courtroom. I was actually in a hallway watching the proceedings on a small little TV screen provided by one of the Twin Cities media. There was a raffle that morning. So many people wanted to get into the courtroom from the community and from the press that there was actually a raffle held where you put business cards in a big box, and the sheriff drew from that. Unfortunately, WPR didn't get in, but I still was able to see there was a lot of emotion. I mean, the family members testified first, family members of the Kloss family, and it was really intense. A lot of sadness. You know, a couple of the brothers of James testified, a couple of the aunts, Jamie's aunt Jennifer, and others testified, and it was very emotional, very emotional.
Did we learn anything new about that October night when Jamie Kloss's parents were killed and she was kidnapped?
Not really, because when the criminal complaint came out, Patterson had already admitted everything. I mean, from the beginning, he basically told, even when the police pulled him over out near his home in Gordon, the day that Jamie Kloss escaped, he said right away, "I did it." And he gave a full confession. So we knew that he had fully admitted that he had committed these heinous acts. And the details of those acts were already splashed across the media in the criminal complaint, and it was quite gruesome. So all we really learned that was new was just how the family was impacted by it. We also heard a very powerful statement that Jamie Kloss herself wrote. It was read by a guardian ad litem that was appointed on her behalf. So
let's hear a bit of that statement.
I don't want to even see my home or my stuff because of the memory of that night. My parents and my home were the most important things in my life. He took them away from me in a way that will always leave me with a horrifying memory.
And so that's family attorney Chris Grandstrup reading that statement. What was that like, hearing those words from Jamie?
Well, I'll tell you, the hair on the back of my neck stood up because it was so powerful. The one thing that towards the end of the statement that really was impactful was that Jamie had written things like, "I will go on to do great things," and he will not. And she explained how Patterson tried to control her, tried to get her to like him. And she wrote that, you know, he took these things away from me, but he can't take away my freedom. He can't take away my spirit. He tried to have control over me, but now I have control over him because I can tell the judge what I think, how he should be sentenced. And that was very, very powerful.
And let's hear a little bit more.
He thought that he could own me, but he was wrong. I was smarter. I watched his routine, and I took back my freedom. I will always have my freedom, and he will not.
Rich, we also heard the 911 call that Denise Kloss made before she was killed. What was that like?
It was tough. And it kind of, the 911 call had been made public before because of some, there were records requests that media had done. So people had heard it, but, and it's very garbled and without the context of what is happening in that moment, it didn't really resonate. But when we heard it in the courtroom on Friday, we had already read the criminal complaint. We already knew that Jamie and her mother were hiding in the bathtub in the bedroom or in the bathroom while Jake Patterson was breaking the door down. We had already heard that they were sitting in the bathtub and Denise Kloss was giving a bear hug trying to hold Jamie. So it really kind of hit home after, you know, with all that context in mind.
We're talking with Rich Kramer. He's a reporter for WPR based in the Eau Claire studios. And Rich is telling us about the sentencing of Jake Patterson. Rich, we heard the strong words that Judge Babbler had for Jake Patterson. He called him an extreme danger to the public. What did Patterson's defense ask for in this?
Well, Patterson's defense basically started out their statement saying, we know that Jake will die in prison. We know that he's not going to get out. So what they were hoping for was Judge Babbler to give his sentence in a way that at least made it look like there was a possibility of release. They said, knowing full well that he wouldn't be released, but they said that if the sentence included some provisions of early release, that would afford him certain privileges in jail, certain work privileges. But Judge Babbler didn't hear it. The defense also pointed out that Patterson made efforts to speed the trial up. They said that if he had his way, he would have pled guilty the next day and there wouldn't have been a trial. So they tried to point that out as Jake Patterson trying to take responsibility for his actions. But Judge Babbler pointed out that Patterson made statements in jail about fantasizing about kidnapping a girl or killing families. So the judge was not moved much by the defense's attempts to try to humanize Patterson.
And before his sentencing, Patterson had this to say about what he did to Jamie and her family.
I would do like absolutely anything to take back what I did, you know. I would die. I would do absolutely anything.
So what did you see from Jake Patterson in this sentencing?
Well, you know, the camera, there was a pool feed camera that all the media were sharing from. There's one camera, one photographer in there, and aside from everyone else in the courtroom. So I saw the back of his head a lot of the time through a tiny little video screen when I was sitting on the floor in a hallway trying to type as fast as I could. But what I noticed is that certain points when the Judge Babbler was talking about prior statements that Patterson had made, he was shaking his head no. I mean, he was, at one point, he even interrupted the judge because the judge was describing this letter that he had written to members of the media saying that he had fantasized about kidnapping a girl. He wanted to kidnap a girl and killing families, etc. And Patterson actually said something to the effect of, well, you didn't read the rest of the letter. You should read the rest of the letter. So that was about the most we heard out of him. Otherwise, he was pretty much silent the whole time.
Rich, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Rich Kramer is a WPR reporter based in Eau Claire. Coming up, we learn about why we can never just be about burning. Walking can never just be about burning calories and counting steps. The author of A Walking Life joins us in just a moment here on the Ideas Network. We're talking about why walking matters a lot. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Toddlers take more than 2,000 steps an hour. They fall an average of 17 times an hour. We're exploring our motivation to walk, and we're learning why communities' walkability is a big factor in building the social capital, the network of relationships that our society is built on. Do you walk in your everyday life? Why or why not? What are the benefits of that daily walk for you? And what effects does walking have on your brain and body? We're at 800-642-1234. Antonia Malchik is a writer based in Montana, and she's author of A Walking Life, Reclaiming Our Health and Our Freedom One Step at a Time. Antonia, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you so much for having me. Good morning.
So in your book, you tell the story of trying to get from Barnes & Noble to the grocery store across the street with your children. Tell us about that experience and how it made you think about the inability to walk.
So this was when I was living in upstate New York, where I lived for about 12 years, although it's barely upstate. I'm originally from Montana, so upstate New Yorkers don't call where we lived upstate, but New York City people do, so I'm never quite sure where it was exactly. It was one of those in-between regions. But we had, and I'm sure most Americans know what this looks like, we had this one area where we had a grocery store and a four-lane road that we had to cross to get to the Barnes & Noble and the Lowe's, you know, that sort of, I call them box lands, the sort of big box areas. And I was at the Barnes & Noble with my kids, where I took them frequently because they have that little Thomas the Tank Engine train table, and the kids could play there. and then I needed to get groceries, and my daughter needed her nap. You know, it's a pretty standard scene. But the thing is, to get across the road to the grocery store, I had to get them in the car. And anyone with really young children knows what an ordeal that is. If they're kind of cranky, they've been arguing with each other, it's hot outside, you know, and it was nuts to me. Like, there was no crosswalk at this place. It was literally right across the street, but you physically could not walk there. You legally couldn't walk there, and physically it would have been really dangerous because there was no crosswalk timer. There was no crosswalk signaling, nothing to accommodate someone actually walking across the road. You had to drive across the road. And it really came home to me how much of our lives is dictated by where cars can go instead of where people can go.
And our streets haven't always been this way. There was a time, you know, we can't remember, before cars, and you looked into that for your book. Tell us what cities and towns looked like, how they operated and were designed before cars.
Well, it's something that I hadn't thought about, and I'm sure most of us don't, but I had published an essay about the loss of walkability in the U.S. specifically, and someone sent me a video from San Francisco in 1906, and I think it was a camera that was mounted on the front of one of the streetcars going down Market Street. And it's fascinating to watch because you see people just crossing the street any old place. There's no traffic lights. There's no stop signs. There's no crosswalks. And what I get really stuck on is that people are not looking when they're crossing the street. You know, when we cross a street, whether we're at a crosswalk or we're jaywalking, whatever we're doing, we look constantly because you never know when a car is coming, when someone's not paying attention. You know, you flip your head back and forth, left, right, left, right. In this video, nobody does that. No, you know, grown-ups, kids, they are just all over the place, and it's really a free-for-all. And so it's a contrast in the public space. We used to have access and an equal right to use that public space, and we lost that throughout the 1900s.
Well, speaking of jaywalking, what did you learn about jaywalking through your research?
So jaywalking was invented, which sounds weird to say, but it's true, in the kind of 1920, like right before 1920s, and then it was really pushed hard in the 1920s. And it was invented by the automobile industry because there were so many traffic deaths. There were more traffic deaths in the years after World War I than people had actually died in the war. So it was a disastrous situation. And there were all these cities across the country who were passing laws, you know, banning cars, reducing the speed limit to 5 miles an hour. People who drove were called killers. Cars were called deadly machines. You know, this was not something where everybody had a car and we had to figure out how to accommodate them. They were really seen as a horrible influence, having a really detrimental impact on people's lives, especially children, since children still played in the street at that time. And the car industry was basically like, we need to do something about this because we can't sell cars if they're seen as a deadly menace. So they started to shift blame to people who were on the road. And they coined the term jaywalker, and it was a derogatory term referring to kind of country bumpkins. You know, people would come to the city and not know how to walk on the road. And they roped in schools to teach traffic safety and the Boy Scouts to hand out jaywalking tickets that weren't legally enforceable, but they did shame people. And then through the 30s, you started to see the introduction of traffic lights and crosswalks and all this infrastructure that reinforced this idea that if you're walking across the road, you have a very limited time and space to do so.
We're talking with Antonia Malchik. She's the author of A Walking Life, Reclaiming Our Health and Our Freedom One Step at a Time. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you walk in your everyday life? Why or why not? What are the benefits of that daily walk to you? You can call in, email ideas at WPR.org. Antonia, you write a lot about walkable communities and how that relates to social capital. Can you explain what you mean by social capital and how that relates to walking?
Sure. Social capital was coined in the early 1900s, but it really just means neighborliness, and we all know what that looks like. So it's how often people are able to interact with each other in inconsequential settings builds a sense of community is what happens. So, you know, if you're living a physically restricted suburban life where you have to get to everything via car, then where you meet people is really limited and defined by your activities, like your job, going to the gym, your kids' school. Whereas if you live in a walkable community, which I do, I live in my small hometown in Montana, you see people all the time in varying situations. And you see people that you wouldn't always see if you just went to places like your job or the gym or the school. And what that builds is a sense of community so that, say, when you have times of crisis, like a flood, a hurricane, out in the West we have wildfires, you really know how to work together. You kind of know who your leaders are, you know who your neighbors are, who needs help. So social capital can really help when a community faces disaster. And just in general, it builds more social and civic engagement. People are empowered to participate in their local government a lot more when they feel a strong sense of social capital, for example.
And social capital becomes more important, as you say, when communities are faced with a catastrophe or hard times. You looked at how social capital and walkable communities were impacted by the Chicago heat wave of 1995. What did you find out there?
So there's a researcher, a sociologist named Eric Kleinenberg in New York, and he studied this specifically in the 1995 Chicago heat wave. It was really interesting. The districts with the least numbers of deaths were not the ones that were necessarily the most well off. In fact, one of the districts that survived that heat wave the best was one of the poorest in the city. And it was also next to one that it had the most number of deaths that was also one of the poorest in the city. And what the differences he found between these two districts was that Auburn Gresham, which had survived the heat wave pretty well, was a place where there were a lot of interconnected social capital situations. So there were churches, cafes, parks, places where people were out and about all the time, and they knew who needed help during the heat wave. Whereas in the neighboring district, Englewood, didn't have that. They had lost a lot of their, what he calls social infrastructure in the preceding decades. And a lot of people were just left on their own in brick buildings and didn't make it because nobody knew to check up on them. They didn't have any help. So that social capital really, really makes a difference in people's lives.
You really threw yourself into this book. You walked more than 2,000 miles on foot during the last couple of years writing and researching.
That's true. It's not as hard as it sounds, actually. It sounds like a lot, but it averaged out to about 2.5 miles a day, which is, I'd say, about 40 minutes. You know, and obviously I didn't just walk 40 minutes every day. There were some days that had a lot more, but it really starts to build up and it feels good, I have to say.
We are on an exploration of walking and how it's fundamental to our being. We're finding out how it's being designed out of our lives and why we need to rediscover it. No matter how we walk, on two legs or using a wheelchair, the book is called A Walking Life. Antonia Melchik stays with us. Your insights, your stories on walking at 800-642-1234. Do you walk to work? Do you find that people are surprised to hear that? Do you have a pet that makes you go outside for a walk every day? Why do you appreciate that? Call in. You can also tweet us at WPR Mornings. Coming up, we'll learn how walking can benefit our well-being. That's after a news update. Stay with us here on the Ideas Network. We're talking about the new book, A Walking Life, here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Author Antonia Melchik writes, access to walking isn't just about our health. It's like the earth's fragile, fruitful crust. It holds us together. It allows ideas to flourish and societies to form. You can join in. Do you think we've designed walking out of our lives? Is that good or bad? Have you lost the ability to walk? Were you able to relearn? We're at 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. Antonia Melchik has spent the past couple years writing and researching this book about walking, and in the process, she's walked upwards of 2,000 miles on foot. Let's go to John now, joining us from Richland Center. Good morning, John.
Good morning. It takes a carpenter a million steps to build a house. But I'd like to talk about the benefits of walking in the woods.
Oh, yes. What about the woods and a walk?
Oh, it's great for your ankles and your calves and your thighs and your back. And you can listen to the birds. I like to hear the woodpeckers hammering away at the wood. The coyotes. It's such a beautiful, and the flowers and the trees are really beautiful nowadays.
Mm. John, thank you so much. Antonia, he loves his walk in the forest. What do we know about those types of walks?
I am so glad he brought that up, actually, because walking in nature has tremendous health benefits, both physically and mentally. It's interesting he mentioned good for your ankles, because walking on terrain that's not super flat is very good for your bones and also for your brain health, because you have to process different information every second, you know, every moment that you're stepping. But also, there has been a lot of research over the last decade about the benefits of just being in nature. In Japan, there's a practice called Shinrin-yoku, forest bathing. And it was so popular that the government actually financed a long-term study to see if there were actually any health benefits. And what they found was that being among trees does significantly reduce your cortisol levels, which is your stress, and lowers your blood pressure. And that was backed up by some research in Germany. There's been a lot of initiatives in Scotland about getting people out to walk in the woods, because they found that trees have this compound called phytoncide that people can benefit from. And when we're among it, when we inhale it, it does help reduce our stress and lower our blood pressure. And there's been a lot of other studies, most of them in Europe, some in the U.S. I think there was actually one in Wisconsin about teenagers and attention. Teenagers who spend time in green spaces, you know, walking among trees and in parks, have greater attention span. And there's another study that showed lower levels of aggression among teenagers. And then in Europe, walking in green spaces has a lot of impact on depression, how people experience depression in particular.
Do you see that people in European countries do walk more than we do here in the U.S.?
I haven't looked at any statistics on that. I think it's true. You know, when people go to Europe, one of the things they really enjoy is being able to walk around the cities. And I think it's just that the cities are so old that they were initially structured around people being able to walk in them. They were not built around the car during the 20th century. So it's just a lot easier to get around. And also public transportation is very supported in Europe, and having that component added to walkability is important for being able to get around easily without a car.
And we here in the U.S. have spent a good part of a century designing walking out of our lives. Do you see that trend reversing at all? Are city and regional planners starting to understand the value of walkability?
I think so. And I'm sometimes a little hesitant to say that because I'm so immersed in the research that I talk to a lot of people who are working on this. But I think it is a trend. When you look at cities around the U.S., you know, leaders know that the population is growing and it's going to continue to grow. And you can only accommodate so many cars. And I think we passed the point that point a long time ago. And people are realizing that we need different ways of moving around. We can't keep outbuilding our highways. We can't keep sprawling out into the suburbs. And people are healthier and more connected. It's better for air quality. So I have seen a lot of municipalities and states around the country that are working on walkability initiatives and starting to prioritize that. There is a bit of a disconnect still with the federal government, the way the funding is structured. So that's where you get to sort of the wonky policy stuff. But I think it'll catch up eventually. But, you know, the machineries of large government tends to work very slowly. But people are starting to get more aware of that.
Chris from Marshfield called in to say he's a nurse on a stroke unit. And he says our bodies are made to walk. It helps our heart, our brain, our digestion, relieves constipation, helps with depression and more. He often tells his patients to walk if they're able to. What do we know about the health impact here?
Oh, he's right. It's really huge. Interestingly, moderate exercise, there's been a lot of research on the health benefits of moderate exercise, specifically walking, in particular over the last few years. It doesn't help with obesity levels so much. That is much more linked to diet. But it is crucial for cardiovascular health, bone density. You know, if you're sedentary, you do lose bone strength, and that includes children. It's really important for them to move their body around. And it is important for brain health. There's been a number of studies on people over 70, for example, if they walk 2 to 3 hours a week, like 30 minutes a day, their rates of dementia are decreased, their risk of Alzheimer's is decreased. And for children, it's really, really important for how they develop their brains as they grow.
Is creativity have a link to walking? Can we connect the benefits of walking to our creativity?
Yeah, there has been a study out of Stanford that found the students who walked prior to taking a test were had increased critical thinking skills. They were much more imaginative in the way they solved problems. And that, going back to the earlier comment, that effect was much stronger when they had walked in green spaces. And I think a lot of people know this. One of the reasons I wanted to write this book was because so much of the writing about walking that's out there is about creative people in history. So some of our most famous poets and philosophers, you know, Socrates, Wordsworth, thinkers like Einstein, composers like Tchaikovsky and Beethoven, they were all tremendous walkers, and they swore by it. You know, when they were creating, they went for really long walks wherever it was they lived. And I think you can talk to artists and writers nowadays, and everyone swears by walking. When they're stuck or when they're kind of finished with work for the day, it really helps your mind process, let go. It lets your subconscious work. I think we're going to see a lot more research on that.
We're talking with Antonia Malchik. She's the author of the new book, A Walking Life, and we're talking about a walking way of life. My kids and I go on an evening walk every day. We call it a bear hunt, and there's a trail and a stream across from where we live, and we're really grateful for that forested parkland with lots of rocks and trees, and it's really the best way to end the day. You can join in with your thoughts on walking at 800-642-1234. Are there sidewalks, trails, or paths that make walking in your neighborhood accessible? Would you like your community to be more walkable? Why do you think it's important? You can call in or email ideas at WPR.org. Antonia, let's get into the science behind walking, the actual act of taking a step, because there is so much going on. Can you break down what's happening? How do our bodily systems work together to walk?
It's really fascinating. And I have to say, I have never stopped being interested in the fact that this action is so complex that the smartest engineers in the world still can't build a robot that really does it in the way that we do. Because we think of robotics as so advanced, but walking is a lot more advanced. So when you take a step, if you think about it, assuming you're, you know, able-bodied and walking on 2 feet without an aid, you press one foot on the ground and you lift the other and you balance just for a moment on the ball of your foot and your toes. Your big toe is really important in this process. I know someone who lost his big toe and had to relearn to walk all over again. And then you shift your weight onto that foot. Your entire body is balanced on this tiny little point for that second. And at the same time, you're using your knee as a pendulum and your hips, and you're swinging the other foot forward. And while you're doing that physically, you're taking in sensory information from your feet and from the space around you. So your feet have proprioceptors, which tells you how much pressure you're putting on them. It tells you what the terrain is like if it's icy or if there's gravel. And then the vestibular system in your inner ear is taking in cues from the world around you. Not only, say, if there's someone walking towards you that you need to veer around, but also the gravitational pull of the earth, which sounds a little wild, but we are on a – I know it's crazy, but it's like we are on a planet that's spinning at 1,000 miles an hour, and our bodies have to account for that, and they do it without us ever realizing it. And that is really fascinating to me.
So the human foot has 26 bones, very hard to replicate. And you've said that, you know, scientists have tried to get robots to walk like us. So what have they tried to do, and how have they failed?
Well, this has been going on for decades, and it started at a university in Japan, where the first ones to build an actual walking robot that could take a step forward. And part of the problem is that those two things I just mentioned, proprioception and the vestibular system, they're not necessarily hard to imitate, but it's hard to build one that can take in the vast amount of information that our brains do, process it, and give that information to the robot so that it can take a step.
Talking with Antonia Melchick, her new book is A Walking Life. You can join in 800-642-1234. Gathering your thoughts on walking, tweet us, WPR Mornings. We'll be back to this in just a minute here on the Ideas Network. We're on a mission to walk more. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. Author Antonia Melchick has a hard sell ending to her book, A Walking Life. She writes, "Walk alone, walk with a friend, walk to think and to grieve, and look outward and find ways to give those denied it the freedom to walk. Keep walking even if you've nowhere to go." Still time for you to join in on walking at 800-642-1234. Have you bonded with a loved one on a walk? Where is your favorite place to think and walk? Join in at 800-642-1234. Author Antonia Melchick stays with us, and she prefers a pair of good boots and socks that don't slip down while she's walking. Let's go to the phones now with Mark joining us from New Berlin. Hi, Mark.
Hi, good morning. Say, I'm an avid walker. I've been walking for years. I'm in my 70s, and I just wanted to mention that Wisconsin has the Ice Age Trail, which is over 1,000 miles of hiking totally within Wisconsin, and we also in Milwaukee. There is the Oak Leaf Trail, which is over 100 miles just in one county. Everywhere you go in Wisconsin, there's hiking, and there's groups of people that hike if you're worried about going out by yourself. There's people that will go with you and make sure, you know, everybody hikes together. They talk a little bit. They listen. And hiking is a year-round activity. It's beautiful to go out in the winter when the trees are without leaves, but it's dead quiet in the country. And it's beautiful to go out in the rain when, you know, when things are there. And you're right, the woodpeckers are fantastic right now.
Oh, Mark, thank you so much. And I love it that he's giving props to the Ice Age Trail, which is truly extraordinary. Antonia?
I have not been there before, but it sounds really fascinating. And I do have an obsession with geology. So that's exactly the kind of thing that I love to walk on. And it's wonderful that he talked about walking in any kind of weather. One of the things that surprised me when I was researching wasn't even about the research itself. It was about my own friends. I would say in our town, you know, let's meet up. And they'd say, meet for coffee. And I'd say, oh, let's go for a walk. And they'd say, oh, if the weather's nice. And it's come home to me over the past couple of years how used to being inside we are and having only the ideal conditions to being outside. And I kind of wonder what we're doing to our bodies and our senses when we limit ourselves so much. You know, if it's a little bit windy, if it's a little drizzly, if it's too hot, a lot of people just will not go for a walk. So I loved it that he talked about any kind of weather and getting out there in the snow and the rain. You know, there's not a lot of conditions that stop you from going for a walk.
Well, walking has been and continues to be symbolic for social and political movements. And you talk about this in your book. Can you talk about some of the marches you profile and why do we band together and march when we want to change?
Well, I think part of that is instinctive. Humans did evolve as tribal creatures. And what that means is that we're used to doing things together as a community. That is how we accomplish things. I know it's very common, especially in the U.S., to think that we're competitive, but that's really not how we succeeded as a species. We succeeded as a species because we work together. And part of that is because walking on 2 feet bipedally as we do makes us kind of helpless in some ways. It gives us a lot of advantages, but physically we're very vulnerable. So I think part of that is instinctive to walk together. And it is also an ancient democratic right. It is in the First Amendment. A lot of people forget about that part. You know, the right to free speech is individual, but the freedom of assembly is collective. And collective action is how people have made progress on social issues and many other issues for centuries. Britain has a long history of marches and probably riots, a lot of them, is what they tipped over into. But the Boston Tea Party, if you really look at it, it was a riot. There was destruction of property, the breaking of laws. And that is how our country started, by people getting up on their feet and taking collective action when they were fed up with what their government was doing.
And even in recent history, you point out that Standing Rock and Dakota Access Pipeline in North Dakota, there's this 2,000-mile relay to resist the Dakota Access oil pipeline. So still, that's very recent history there.
It absolutely is. Yeah, the Standing Rock prayer camp did get a lot of news attention, but even I did not know until I started talking to some of the people who'd started it that was actually begun as a relay run to raise awareness about the Standing Rock situation and the fact that that tribe did not want an oil pipeline crossing through their main water source. So there were people, mostly the International Indigenous Youth Council members, who were running like 50 miles a day, going to the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers to raise awareness.
And you also looked at locomotion studies, this area of research. What have scientists said about the reasons why we started traveling this way?
Nobody really knows, which is interesting in itself. There's a lot of theories out there. One is that it allowed us to be taller so we could see over grasslands. one of the biggest theories is that it did allow us to free our hands and the use of our hands. We couldn't use tools if we didn't have the use of our hands, and those hands have to be free. You know, we evolved from apes and we should be going around on all fours, but we don't. We can walk on 2 feet and use our hands to make fire, carry babies, use tools, and develop civilization.
So after writing and researching about walking for a couple years, immersing yourself in it, in the research, is there anything we really have yet to discover about walking that perhaps is in the future that we'll figure out?
You know, I don't know scientifically what goes on in the brain. I think we're going to discover a lot more, especially in children. I really advocate for getting children outside more and letting them move. You know, they're in school all day and they're very stationary, and that actually has a big impact on how well they can learn. They need to move around in order to develop their hippocampus, which is important for reading ability and mathematical visualization. But I think community is really where we're going to see a lot of work on this in the future. I think it's come home to everybody really in the world, not just in the U.S., that we need to focus on our communities a lot more. We need to pay attention to the loneliness epidemic. We need to pay attention to how resilient our infrastructure is. And to do that, we need to build communities that are walkable, which also means accessible for disability, not just for people who are fully abled. And I think that's where we're going to see a lot of work on this in the future. And I'm hoping that they will then see more health benefits of walking and that it will be equitable. So not just, you know, if you have a nice zip code that can afford to build nice sidewalks, but for everybody being able to access jobs and schools and their neighbors and to get to know one another again and to improve their health at the same time.
Antonia, is there a favorite walk that you like to take that perhaps has more ritualistic meaning to you?
Oh, that's a really good question. I'm from Montana, so I am a mountain girl, but I do love walking in cities, especially European cities. I've spent a lot of time in Moscow because my dad's from Russia and he runs a business there. So I love walking in Moscow and Russia. I love walking in London, but I do also love getting out into the Montana wilderness. And going hunting, for example, you wander off the trail and you're paying attention to every step, every detail. There's really nothing like that experience. If you maybe take a camera or just your attention, go into the woods, go off the trail, you know, if it's legal, you don't want to do that in a national park, for example, and just really pay that slow, careful attention to the world around you. What that does for my attention and my happiness and my ability to cope with life in general is tremendous.
Well, Antonia, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me. It was a pleasure.
Antonia Melchick is a writer based in Montana. Her new book is called A Walking Life, Reclaiming Our Health and Our Freedom One Step at a Time. This is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to the Ideas Network.